The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Music Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alexis Petridis, and coming up, we'll be reacting to Tuesday night's Mercury win for the XX. We'll also be speaking to Carl from Underworld about his new album Barking and why he still loves Essex.
There's a multiplicity to the words as well too, you know, barking, images of dogs that we use a lot in the words, it's barking mad, it's barking, it's that thing of read into it what you will.
Zola Jesus, The Antwoord and Seahawks featuring Singles Club, and we speak to Hyperdub's Iconica about her musical journey from hardcore metal to dubstep.
For me, the dubstep community is always, it hasn't really been about, oh, you're a girl, or wow, you're a girl DJ. It's a bit more intelligent than that.
That's all in Music Weekly. With me today is Rosie Swash.
Hello.
Hello, Rosie. How are you?
Bright-eyed
and bushy-tailed. And also with us, it's Casper Llewellyn-Smith, a senior editor of The Observer Review. Hello, Casper. How are you
Hello.
Doing?
Very well. I'm even brighter and bushier-tailed than Rosie's tail.
That's all. I'm very, very pleased to hear it. Before we get stuck into Underworld, Singles Club and the like, let's have a quick chat about Tuesday night's Mercury Prize. Rosie, you were there.
I was indeed.
The XX, deserved winners?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say. I don't think there was anyone that thought they didn't deserve to win.
Casper, did you feel you were backing Biffy Clyro? Mon the Biffy, you were saying.
I was, yeah. It's sort of slightly bizarrely, only because I thought everything else was sort of slightly obvious choice. The people we're talking about as the favourites, XX or Weller or Wild Beast, I suppose, just sort of all seemed, I mean, even Weller seemed sort of quite an acceptable choice and a slightly dull choice. I mean, I think that's the only criticism of the XX. I can, you know, there's nothing to argue about there with it. It's quite a funny event in that respect, probably more so if you were in the room than watching it on TV, because they announced the winner and that's it. And suddenly one person's won and 9 or 11 other people acts haven't won, and they just sit there and they haven't got anything to do and they just have to kind of look a bit sheepish and go
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a sort of curious one table erupts and this great outpouring of joy and happiness and everyone else does look a bit pissed.
Everybody goes back to the tepid salmon
and say they didn't care after all.
I have to say this though, the performances at the Mercury usually don't captivate me because it's such a vibeless atmosphere, but I thought Villagers.
Everyone was talking about Villagers. Apparently they made Bonnie Sawyer cry.
Oh.
She kept saying on TV, they made me cry.
Well, it's just the one guy, the Connor, I don't know, it was just him on the stage with an acoustic guitar. Maybe the ability to make that good in a room like that is even better.
Wow. Any gossip? Anybody got any good gossip from the Mercurys?
Well, Dave from The Invisible, who was on the panel, assured me that it was between the XX and the Wild Beast, but who knows if that's true.
He's just saying that to get on your good side.
Yeah.
He knows you love the Wild Beast. We've had a few posts about the XX from the website. James312 writes, it has to be the XX, doesn't it? They seem to be the only band on the list that is looking towards the future and incorporating elements of dance music into traditional songwriting. And Fowls might be doing that as well, but anyway. Think it is strange that no one has picked up that they sound like the Young Marble Giants with cheap electronic gear and great songs. I think Young Marble Giants' name has been mentioned quite a lot in relation to the XX. Are you pulling that face?
I just don't think they have that much like them. And even if they do, it's not like saying, oh, they just sound like the Rolling Stones. It means Young Marble Giants are still relatively obscure.
I suppose so, yeah, no, that's very true. EJD writes, what draws me is their sound, and I'm curious how or if they'll expand on it in the future. I think that's a very, very good point, actually. They're the sort of perfectly formed band, and as I think we've said many times in this show, if you arrive perfectly formed, it's very, very difficult for you to develop. I think the album would make a good winner. It has strong identity and it's a debut. Let's put the Mercury Prize to bed and move on to our first interview. Underworld are back with a new record, which is out on Monday. Barking is their sixth studio album. Carl Hyde and Rick Smith have incredibly been working together for 30 years. I think it actually might be more. Anyway, it's awash with collaborations, the new album from the world of dance music. Mark Knight, Darren Price, Apple Blim, High Contrast, they're all involved. I spoke to Carl about their first record in 3 years. We can hear this interview after a track from their new album. This is Scribble.
Time.
You've been working with Rick now for an unbelievably long time. I mean,
yeah, you should see the scars he bears.
Do you both? What sort of drives you? What keeps you going?
I think it's a combination of bloody-mindedness, Welshness, Celtic tradition, and the fact that we are inspired by what comes out of the combination of us. I know for me, certainly, that Rick is the most inspiring, challenging, in a really good way, musician that I've ever met, and continually surprises me. And I'm never bored working with him.
Is your technique with the lyrics still the same as ever? I mean, it is going around basically, I don't say eavesdropping, but you're kind of eavesdropping.
Yeah, that's that's a part of it, but it changes again through our conversations, Rick and I. On this record, for example, a couple of years ago, Rick said to me he didn't want to change the way I wrote, but wouldn't it be great if I could build just a couple of little doors that people could get a clue as to what I was on about, because everything I write is autobiographical, and it makes complete sense to me. They're notations, they're fragments of the world as I see them, and I believe everybody sees the world as a series of fragments. It's just that I happen to write them all down as fast as I can. And his point was, it would be great if you could possibly build a couple of doors just to let people in a bit, give them a few clues as to what you're on about. And I thought, well, that's a interesting challenge. So I tried to do that on this record when I was collecting words, and that will be on my mind when I'm sat there at a cafe and listening to stuff or looking at stuff. Quite often it's not listening, overhearing people's conversations anymore. Quite often it's how I see the things that are going on around me and put them into the head translator that if you were sat there you'd think, how the hell did he get that from that? I really don't know. But that's 20 years of working like this.
Do you still get people waving cans of beer aloft during Born Slip? Because that's the famous sort of misinterpretation of your lyric, is that the shouting lager, lager, lager is the sort of absolute apotheosis of 90s lad culture, which I know for a fact because you told me before that wasn't what you meant at all.
That's right. No, we don't. Strangely, it was a very brief period. It was when Born Slippy came out the first time, I think it was. Certainly if it happened after it was re-released following Trainspotting, it didn't last very long. But now it's euphoria and joy that we see off of people, and as cheesy as that might sound, that is what we...
It's a lovely thing to say.
Well, it's a great job when you're dealing with people that are smiling at you all the time. That's a pretty amazing job.
Sure. The album title, Barking, I mean, do you still live in Essex?
Yeah.
Essex seems to permeate underworld like...
I'm not leaving Essex.
What is it about it that you find inspiring?
It's such a positive place.
Really?
Yeah, particularly South Essex.
Sorry, apologies to any listeners in Essex. I didn't mean to sound so surprised. When
absolutely. I was born and raised in a part of the world, you know, the South West Midlands, where that can get a bit dark and a little bit dour. And if... if things aren't going exactly to plan, it's the end of the world, and yet somehow the world carries on, and we find something else to moan about. And when I came to South Essex, I was just amazed that that people would nothing seemed to ruffle anybody's feathers, and it was the only place that there was never a recession. For one reason or another, people would find a way of getting through, and it's like, stick the kettle on, love, everything's going to be all right. Or whether it was, let's have a beer, and it's going to be fine. I think it's that East End tradition that was moved out after the Blitz and came out there, very much ingrained in the culture, and I loved it. I loved being around it. People were friendly. They opened their doors to me, and I said, I'm a foreigner, really, from a strange land in the Midlands, and everyone said, oh, come around, love, come around, come to tea. I was welcomed into the community, and it was the first time in my life that I actually felt like a part of the community, and I haven't wanted to leave since.
Wow. And is that so? The album is called Barking. Is that to reflect its uplifting and positive?
It's a homage to the homeland, and it's if I can use that combination of words with Essex, but there's a multiplicity to the word as well too. Barking, images of dogs that we use a lot in the words. It's barking mad. It's barking. It's that thing of read into it what you will.
You've handed a lot of tracks on this album almost every track on this album over to other people to remix.
Yeah, but we... They weren't remixes.
The collaborations, how would you...
Yes, they are. It follows that line of starting to work on the Breaking and Entering soundtrack with Gabriel Yared, which is the first time really we'd formed another unit with another composer. My work with Brian Eno that came out on our Athens compilation. And then Mark Knight and Dean Ramirez really sealed it because they made life so easy and so enjoyable when we worked on the downpipe track. That set the thing in motion. But we'd had 20 years of people remixing our tunes.
Of course.
And quite a lot of those we'd hear and be very inspired by. And sometimes you'd hear a track and say, well, I wish that version had been on our album instead of the version that actually came out. We might have moved on quicker. We might have embraced other ideas much faster than we did. And there was always that feeling of like, what a shame the album's out, because it would have been nice to have collaborated, jammed, corresponded with these people. So when it came to this album, Rick was adamant that once we'd finished the tracks and he'd mixed them, we'd listen to them and we'd make decisions as to who we could correspond with. But they had to be people that not only in their style related to each track individually, but also were open-minded enough for a two-way dialogue. It wasn't
sure
about we give you a track and that's it. It's a fait accompli. It had to be, this thing needs to be able to go backwards and forwards. Mm-hmm. And we were fortunate that everyone that we asked was open-minded enough to go along with the concept and come back with things that actually sounded more like Underworld than
that's
than
the
Underworld.
Really interesting thing is that you've handed it over to a really diverse array of producers like Apple Blim, or you've collaborated with people like Apple Blim and Dubfire and, you know, people whose music you wouldn't necessarily associate with Underworld's own, you know. Mm. And it's come back and it sounds like an Underworld album.
It's great, isn't it? Isn't that great?
Yeah. That's Carl from Underworld. We were just talking while that interview was playing, and Rosie, you were saying before their time, before your time, rather.
They
ahead of their time.
Ahead of their time, before your time. That's somewhere you'll meet in the middle. In some.
There was a period, or an era in the 90s, late 90s, where they seemed to represent a host of kind of faceless, quite not matcha but kind of ghostly, lifeless dance music for me anyway. I mean, we all know the dance music that I was into at that period of time.
You were twice as nice.
Exactly.
With a big bottle of champagne
big
on a Sunday morning.
Big faces on that.
Big faces.
Yeah, not faceless.
Anyway, yes. So I completely disagree. I loved Underworld. When they first came out, I was saying this earlier. I remember Dub No Bass and My Headman came out, their debut album came out around the same time as Definitely Maybe by Oasis. I was at university, and I remember hearing them both and thinking, like, this is just the future. This is totally the future of music. You know, they're like a band, but it's electronic and it's different. Everybody's going to want to sound like them. And just completely disregarded the fact that everybody's actually going to want to sound like Oasis. Once again, demonstrating my brilliant capacity to predict the future. It's made me Britain's top rock critic. Casper, are you a fan of Underworld?
In as much as they sort of, yeah, probably a bit like you, they remind me of a period of my youth, or my sort of quasi youth, and I haven't really paid attention for the last how many other albums it's been, 3 or 4 records, yeah, I would guess at this stage.
They slipped out of the public consciousness, I think, a little bit with their third album, which is rather opaque, Beau Coupe Fish, which came out, I think, 1999. But they have actually made loads of really good records since then, and the new album is really, really interesting in that every single track is a collaboration with another producer, and quite sort of as we were saying in the interview, you know, it's quite odd. And the album itself sounds like Underworld, even though it's got sort of dubstep produced and things like that on it, which is quite intriguing. Did it sort of tickle you? I mean, did you just think, God, I wish I was back at twice as nice?
Always. I mean, that's what I think every morning when I wake up. But except for maybe this morning. It was much poppier than the image of them that I'd built in my mind. Mm. And I mean, when you say dubstep producers, isn't there Paul Van Dyke's on there? So it's pretty mainstream.
They've got a very wide range. I mean, Dubfire, who's sort of used to be in Deep Dish and is now sort of a more minimal producer, is on there. Apple Blim is on there as the dubstep and High Contrast on both. So it's a wide range of stuff.
I too have listened to this record though, and I think you're right that it does sound like an Underworld record. And there's also, you know, it's not totally my cup of tea, his sort of chain of consciousness, stream of consciousness lyrics. But there is a sincerity there about it, and there is a kind of feeling of place and where they're from, and you know, I suppose it helps that the record's called Barking, which is a reference to Essex and where they're from, and that's a kind of clue to it. But it does have that feeling of a record from a particular place and that kind of sense of purpose about it, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking it's sort of intriguing that Underworld have been going in one form or another for this long, you know, at a time when most other dance acts, the other big dance acts of that era, Orbital, Left Field, the exception of the Chemical Brothers, all kind of broke up. And I was wondering why that was. And then I thought, came with a quite prosaic answer. They probably just didn't do loads of cocaine and fall out. So
that answers that question.
That's that cleared up then. Not that I'm for a minute suggesting that Orbital did a load of cocaine and fell out. Certainly Left Field did. But I just think they're a really intriguing band. And I think they're a band that deserve... I think the history of the 90s has been kind of rewritten to exclude dance music a little bit. And we now, these days, you know... I think largely because of John Harris's book, The Last Party, which is a very good book. But, you know, you tend to think that the 90s is all about kind of Noel Gallagher shaking Tony Blair's hand. And, in fact, you know... Thank God that wasn't actually true. And, you know, Underworld, Born Slippy, you know, I think is probably the single most... I said in the interview, it's probably the single most extreme piece of music ever to make number two in the charts. It's got no tune at all. It's just sort of hammering beats. And there was all these kind of interesting things happening, and it would be nice if a band like Underworld, I think... were sort of celebrated and revered in the same way as their guitar-slinging contemporaries of that era, because they were more interesting and a better group. Barking from Underworld is out on Monday on Cooking Vinyl. Go and check it out. Right, it's time for the Singles Club now. We've each brought in a track to discuss, and this one was chosen by... Do you notice I'm starting to do this pause? It's like on Britain's Next Top Model when they go, you know, the person next on the running is... This single was chosen by Rosie. That was Sea Talk by Zola Jesus. Rosie, your choice?
Yes, indeed. We were trying to decide exactly what that reminded us of, because it immediately made me think of Cocteau Twins. Or more specifically, actually, this Mortal Coil. But it's...
She's definitely got a hint of Liz Fraser.
There's something there, isn't there? But I know what you mean. It feels like that's not quite the right reference.
It seems more epic and less introverted than the Cocteau Twins.
But that's, I mean, I just think it's that old trick of it's very emotionally melodic plus also quite industrial. Mm. And the mix of the two is great, and it's got a very epic feel to it. The downside of it is the whole album is on that one.
Really?
Yeah, it doesn't really deviate from that. But I think when she gets it right, I think her name's Nick or something.
Or Nika. Knickers?
No, Nika, like Nika. Right.
Suddenly you look more interested in that.
Yeah.
It'd be amazing if she was actually called Knickers.
And it's... that would be amazing.
I think it'd be amazing.
All right, it would be amazing. I was asking Tim Jones, who introduced me to Zola Jesus, how he would describe his music, and he described it as hipster goth.
Hipster goth. So we have to be careful. I tell you what, we have to be careful because I got... a mail out from Fonica Records the other day, and it went, "Oh, the Guardian are at it again, having come up with this name." What's that name that you use for that music that sounds a bit like shoegazing? Chill wave. Thank you. Having come up with chill wave. Did we invent
chill
wave?
No, we said specifically we did not invent chill wave. We've never claimed
it. This is the Guardian all over. This is like when I said dance music was dead in a feature that I specifically said. Actually said in the feature, dance music is not dead. Mm. And they put in the stand first, dance music is dead, says Alexis Petrides. Anyway, Casper, did you like Zola Jesus?
I did quite like it. Jesus Mary Chain was the thing I was just thinking of. That's because I was thinking then of the Cocteau Twins, and it put me in a sort of...
Nostalgic frame of mind.
It's like Underworld again. I did like it. I was sort of slightly disappointed here. The whole album's on that kind of one vibe. I liked it as a single. You can sort of imagine a teenage girl who likes Florence and the Machine kind of graduating to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or her slightly kind of hipper younger sister who's, you know, grown out of the Twilight films, you know. Or her appearing on the soundtrack to the next, whatever she's called, Stephanie Meyer adaptation for the big screen.
I think that's a good point. I think it's quite commercial sound.
Yeah.
I think it's also interesting that, because going back to Chillwave, The problem that I've actually listened to quite a lot of these young chillwave artists, and that is the problem that you're talking about with Zola G's, the problem that I have with a lot of their records, in that they're sort of totally emotionally or stylistically monotonal. There's no up and down. Mm. There seems to be kind of a bit of malaise in music at the moment. It's people hit on a style, and it's not necessarily a bad style, but they stick with it. You know what I mean? You said Las Vegas, Casper, in relation to this music. I feel like a little bit about Las Vegas' music. It sort of starts, and it's like that, and now ends, and it's still like that.
Go out, do a bit of washing up, come back, still the same thing.
Still moaning on, like an episode of Taggart produced by Alan Mulder. Anyway, excuse me. So we like Zola G's.
I do. I mean, I've got two things that I've written down next to the own single that I brought in. One is that the whole album is a bit like this, and the other is that the simple platitudes, the lyrics of the album in general, it's all a bit, makes me think of those montages of teen shows on E4 where everyone's looking at each other longingly or running into each other's arms, but you're not really sure what the issues at heart are.
Like at the end of the end of the show.
Yeah.
It's the sort of thing that would get played.
Or quite a good insight today into the TV that the pair of you watch, with you watching America's Taggart Next Top Model and Taggart, and you watching you want to get out more. Hill.
No, I think it's the kind of thing, you're absolutely right, that could be played at the end of Grey's Anatomy while two recently reconciled lovers kiss in the rain and a child expires in a hospital bed.
Two characters are just looking at each other longingly.
I'll tell you what, if it is, she's quids in. Because I've got a mate who's in a band, and their career has faded a little bit in Britain, still touring America. They've got a mate, gets them on the soundtrack of like Grey's Anatomy, all this kind of thing, once a year. And they make more money off that than they do touring the States for 6 months a year. So there you go. Sea Talk by Zola G's is out on the 12th of October on Sacred Bones Records. She really is going for the goth angle, isn't she? Let's have a listen to Casper's Choice. Rolling with the S.O.S. High energy, you never seen Zeph so fresh. When we mark, check hard, that flows flex. Yo, we off the must up, not fuck in the press. We not like the rest, my style is UFO. Totally unknown, you can't fuck with my new Zeph flow. I'm hard to miss, you're going to this, you're going to that. You fucking who said so? I do it a lot, too hot to handle, too cold to hold. You can't fuck with the chosen one, I want to knock your arm, a ninja. A stunned silence descends upon the studio as De Antwoord, with Enter the Ninja, fades away. We should point out this tune has been out for ages, but it was re-released in August, plus we haven't spoken about them that much on the pod. Casper, other than wanting to plug an interview in this this Sunday's Observer,
yes.
What caused you to bring that in?
They're a band in whom I've been interested since they suddenly appeared out of nowhere at the start of the year. I don't know how familiar you are with the story of them, but a video of those was posted, I think, on the website Boing Boing, which kind of collects weird stuff, not just music, from around the world, and it kind of curates that stuff. And they appeared there, and suddenly overnight the band had thousands of messages sent to them, and people like David Fincher, the film director, got in touch, said he loved them. The guy directed District 9, that South African sci-fi film, got in touch saying you're my favourite band. The girl, singer Yolandi, was apparently approached to play the lead role in The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Really?
So it's a sort of strange, bizarre story, and they're these, you know, two kids from a very poor bit of South Africa. That's why they sound the way they do, with that kind of Afrikaans inflected rapping style, and a lot of it goes into Afrikaans, and suddenly a sort of signed to Interscope in the States have been playing, I think they played Coachella, and you know, they're suddenly very hip. They had a gig, was that last weekend, at the LED Festival, maybe 2 weekends ago, where they appeared, and then during the Aphex Twins set they came on dressed in some bizarre costumes and were rapping along with that. So it's just a kind of bizarre.
There is a suggestion, phenomenon. I think we should address this, there is a suggestion the whole thing's a scam, isn't it? There is a suggestion the whole thing's a hoax, and that it appeared to have sort of come out of nowhere. And, you know, it's one of these, it's like Disco Lento, Hertz's made-up genre that they were influenced by.
My understanding is that it is very much for real. I mean, I think, you know,
it's not like a bloke in Dalston.
It's not a bloke in Dalston. I mean, if you hear them, it's unmistakably them. Those accents are authentic. I think the other thing that people say is it's a kind of joke. It's done as a kind of comedy record. And certainly, our interviewer for this piece on Sunday found sort of quite the contrary. They're quite serious about what they do, really? And sort of get a little bit shirty about any suggestion.
Are people genuinely digging it, or are they sort of laughing at them?
Well, Hermione Hobie went to interview them for a saw them play in Germany and said actually they were amazing on stage and just had this incredible energy. And, you know, I think it's one of those things, isn't it? You know, the initial reaction is to kind of laugh at it. But if you kind of step back and the guy's called Ninja... and it is sort of a bit ridiculous, but I think he is probably quite a good rapper.
Yeah,
you know, and somehow that language and the voice seems to suit hip hop quite well as well. It is kind of those hard consonants, and it, you know, it works quite well. It's strange, but there is something quite fresh about it as a piece of pop music. I think it works really well.
Something different, isn't it, Rosie? You did the expression on your face suggests that you were not really down with.
Well, I wouldn't say I like. I didn't say I like it. There's something quite compellingly grotesque about the whole thing. I mean, if you haven't seen the video is purposefully incredibly strange and a bit visually repulsive in places. And his whole, you know, all his mannerisms, and you know, without meaning to be too down on the Afrikaan language, it is, you know, protection. It's quite hard on the ears.
Reminds me, actually, it's interesting listening to that. What it reminded me most of is Gabba music, because you used to get people rapping over the top of this kind of "I'm the fuck you man" over the top, you know. So it was kind of weird. And not altogether pleasant to be taken back.
But you know, what it also reminds me of is what they claiming to represent is kind of not that different from Insane Clown Posse, another horrible collection of sounds.
But I mean, you could say that what they're claiming to represent is not that different from Eminem.
Yeah,
Eminem,
true.
I'm sure he's Eminem. Sure South Africa. Because it's the sound of the, you know, I mean, we hear a bit of kind of, you know, South African techno, and we have a South African house music special, and we hear a bit that's the kind of the sound of the kind of you know, black underclass or whatever in South Africa. You never hear anything about kind of, you know, poor Afrikaans. You don't really hear their kind of music or their culture represented very much. So you could say that's kind of in the same way that Eminem was the sound of the, you know what I mean, the Michigan trailer parks or whatever.
It's just that Eminem was so noticeably pop in so many ways that he was able to be embraced by the people, and cleverer. I mean, the lyrics in this song are not particularly clever. It's just the various ways in which he's going to beat you up.
Yeah. Hip hop's a bit like that.
Yeah, lots of hip hop is like that, but Eminem had more of a story.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
I wouldn't say that.
What I will share with you, though, is that that Ninja, as he's known, transpires his real name is Watkin Tudor Jones.
Wow.
So there you go.
I can't believe that he took a great name, like Watkin Tudor Jones, and changed it to Ninja. Ninja's
but Watkin Tudor Jones, it probably would work quite well if he was a member of Mumford & Sons or something. Not if you want to be South Africa's premier number one rave hip-hop.
In which case, Ninja.
Crossover, in which case,
is,
Ninja.
Is much better. Enter the Ninja by De Antwoord is out now. Now, change your pace. It's time for my choice. That was High Seas Drifter by Seahawks, my choice. Give you a little bit of background. Seahawks are the musical vehicle of Pete Fowler, who's better known as an illustrator, does all the sort of Super Furry Animals covers, and has produced a series of really intriguing compilations in his own right called Sounds of Monsterism Island, to collect kind of lots of weird things together, like Ghost Box and BBC Radiophonic Workshop and da-da-da-da. But he describes this project as cosmic yacht rock. Already, you see, I heard that phrase and I thought, this is for me. I really like it. They've been putting stuff up on their blog for a long time, and they've put a single out on Static Caravan. They've got some other stuff coming out shortly. I really like this kind of manipulation of kind of soft rock, you know, that sort of bargain bin stuff into kind of lovely air-like soundscapes. I think it works really well. I, as regular listeners to this podcast know, I like at the moment music that sounds like you're listening to Heart FM on loads of drugs. So this really fits with my current aesthetic. Casper.
Well, yeah, you see, when you say the words yacht rock, and I'd read that before listening to it, my heart rather sank instead. I go the other way to you, and I don't really quite get that aesthetic. For me, it kind of verges off more into kind of Sean Rowley guilty pleasures kind of territory, and it has a kind of slight whiff of sort of being a bit smarter than it, or less smarter than it thinks it is. And yet, I quite like this record in the end.
There you go. Rosie?
See, I read on the very small bit of information on the blog page that it was a tribute to cod reggae.
I think there's a lot of sea-related puns in what they do.
I see. Okay, so that makes more sense.
But it could be that thing, because there is that kind of crossover point where you get a lot of, kind of after the Police,
yeah,
you do get a lot of people sort of dabbling with a little hint of a reggae beat in what
I guess
they do.
I just don't know. Is it being ironic? No, or is it revelling in the joys of soft
rock? I think it's revelling in the joys of a cut. There is, you know, as I have discovered over the last 18 months, I think there's a lot of pleasure to be had from these. I genuinely do, and I'm not listening to it go, you know what I mean? I wouldn't waste my time listening to music and go, it's so awful. You know, I really, really do. You know, I really do like it. And I like the kind of... The sort of, I think a lot of the bands that do this well, that have sort of taken this influence on well, like Gangs and Aerial Pink's Haunted Graffiti, concentrate on the fact there's slightly weird, fuzzy, psychedelic edges, maybe by accident, on those original records, and elaborate on those, and that's what this does.
If it was an outfit, Alexis, you know about clothes. If it was an outfit, what kind of outfit would it be?
It would be an amazing outfit I'd be happy to wear. So, yeah, I don't think it's meant to, I don't think it's meant ironically. I think some of the imagery around it is kind of, you know, slightly... mocking the way these things are presented, but I just I think it's pretty earnest.
Right,
High Seas Drifter by Seahawks is available as a download from their website, which is seahawks77.wordpress.com. That is your lot for Singles Club. Our next interview is with Iconica, a dubstep producer from the fantastic Hyperdub stable. Rosie, you met with her.
I did indeed. She's been called the First Lady of dubstep, of course she has, but she's not a fan of this tag, as you'll hear in a bit. Bizarrely, for a dubstep producer, she used to be in a hardcore metal band.
Wow.
So when she came in, I asked her why she changed her direction so drastically.
I just had my own ideas, and at first I wanted to make just hip-hop instrumentals. Obviously, I didn't want it to sound like new metal or all that rubbish that we, you know. So yeah, and then yeah, when everyone was just like, oh, let's just not bother with the band anymore because it's you know, it's too much hard work, and also I wasn't really that much into hardcore anymore. Like it pretty much died out to a lot of people around me, so the interest wasn't there. I just got back into hip hop, like listening to a lot of Madlib and J Dilla, anything on Stones Throw really, and then found dubstep. I really liked it and started to investigate a little bit more about dubstep. I liked it because it was from London. The BPM seemed really kind of new to me.
One of the things which I think is really great about UK dance, you know, what's happening with the evolution of dubstep, is it feels like there's a lot of music that's kind of a little bit genreless in a good way,
yeah,
or at least boundary free. But you know, any sort of decent producer, like you said, at least has a distinctive sound. What would you say your distinctive, Iconica's distinctive sound is?
I don't know, I never wanted to follow like conventional formulas or structures. I wanted to write songs rather than beats. Like being a drummer as well, I think that's why I never played drums in a hip-hop band. Just because I didn't want to like play the same beat for 5 minutes. I wanted to be a bit more intense. I wanted to just do something wacky, change the structure completely, have that contrast between melodies and something that was heavy. to me, my sound is more just more about structure and progression and melodies, but with really big sub bass.
One of the things you yourself said in an interview with the Guardian a couple of months ago was you take an issue with the First Lady of Dubstep tag, but you said you was trying to see the funny side.
Yeah.
Has that been successful? Do you find it humorous? Or is it still annoying?
It's a little bit annoying, but I'm like,
Do you think it's patronising?
No, not really. I don't see what the big deal is. Like, just obviously I've been a girl all my life. And it's like, I don't know how I'm supposed to look at it from the outside. For me, dubstep, the dubstep community is always, it hasn't really been about, oh, you're a girl, or you shouldn't DJ because you're a girl, or wow, you're a girl DJ. It's a bit more intelligent than that, you know? But saying that, I really like it when, like recently my gigs have been, like the first two rows have been like full of girls and they're watching me and it's really nice. So in that sense, it's cool and everything. But I don't want to be marketed as like female producer. It's just like, no, I'm a producer, thanks, you know. Or, you know, play like all female DJ shows, which could be cool and stuff, but you know, it's...
I think it would be better if it was all female audiences sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I guess, I mean, it's not obviously that kind of tag is not specific to dubstep across music. You always get, I mean, we had a press release the other day and this was what a PR actually wrote. I won't say who the artist is, but said, if you like female singer-songwriters, maybe you'll like this one.
Yeah.
It's not a genre.
It's not a genre, it's not a category.
One of the things that's been said about dubstep in the last couple of years, and is still being said, is that the more kind of vocal-led it becomes, the more likely it is to be mainstream. And you've seen, you know, the likes of Katy B or Roses for Born, and you think that they could really stand a good chance of that being the case. I mean, do you think it's the right time for that? Do you particularly care if dubstep becomes chart-friendly?
You know, there's many different sides to dubstep. There's the really ravey stuff, you know, the wobble stuff, there's like techno side of it, there's the two-step side of it. If certain artists want to become mainstream and do that and are happy with it, then, and people are supporting it, then I think it's fine. You know, I really like that Katy B and Benga song, and I think that's a really good look for dubstep. For that particular commercial dubstep sound, I think that's a very good example of it. But yeah, you know, dubstep's pretty old. I mean, in the last 5 years, it's managed to grow and grow. So we should celebrate that, the progression of it, and how much it's mutated, and it has a future. So, you know, that's the positive side of it. I don't really care about the negative side.
Good for her.
Yeah, that's you sold. That was Iconica talking to Rosie there. That all sounded great to me, actually, the stuff that's in the background. Where does she sit within the sort of pantheon of dubstep producer? I mean, is she a sort of big deal? Is she tipped to cross over?
I don't think she's going to cross over. I think there's something a little too avant-garde about what she does. But I think what she nails with her sound is the balance between being quite experimental with the direction that her music's moving in, but you feel like it's not off-putting. You feel like you're
in the
inside of what's going on, and it's not kind of showy offy. No. And also, I don't want to make too much of her Egyptian heritage, but there is to a lot of her music a bit of a sort of Middle Eastern twang to the melody. Sounds pretty awful.
I think that's quite interesting. In that, you know, I'm sure she's not doing it consciously, but perhaps if you're surrounded by, you know what I mean, it just seeps in. There's different ways of writing tunes, and there's different sort of modalities and things like that.
And not to take it back to the Mercurys, which we promised we'd put to bed, but you know,
you wake it up again.
Yeah, wake up. A couple of years ago, they gave it to. It was Elbow and Burial in the same year?
I think it was.
Yeah, an Elbow one. And I'm not saying that's a bad decision, but if the Mercury stands to represent where, you know, if you could look back on it, what does music mean in that year, then you feel like albums like this that are being made now have a lot indebted, not necessarily to Burial, but what was happening in that time period. So it's a shame that if you were to look back in years to come, you'd probably completely forget that actually dubstep and Burial, well, what Burial represented in that year was probably a lot more than what Elbow represents.
Yeah, it's a good point. So, Iconica, I think it is interesting that she doesn't want to be labelled as a sort of female. You'd kind of think that we'd be a bit beyond this by now.
But it's different in dance music because it's actually very rare. Mm. Don't you think? I mean, you know, you're more likely to see women on the mic singing than you are behind a wealth of technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I suppose it's kind of a slightly nerdy, blokey, you know what I mean? Slightly sort of semi-autistic pursuit, isn't it, producing?
I found it very heartening to her talk about the way she switched on to dubstep and was completely embraced by the dubstep community.
Yeah, no, it is good. As is Iconica's album, Contact, Love, Want, Have, which is out now on the Hyperdub label. That's all for this week. Thank you very much, Rosie.
A pleasure.
Oh. and thank you very much, Casper.
That's also my pleasure.
It was my pleasure. Thanks to our producer, Pete. And I'm Alexis Petridis. I'll see you later. Take care.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.